Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. It's our Friday Media Roundtable, and it's been a big week for news. Yesterday, the Senate authorized the Pentagon to train and arm Syrian rebels to fight against ISIS, or the Islamic State. Earlier in the week, the House also passed legislation in an unusually bipartisan vote. So how has this been covered, and are journalists asking and answering the most important questions for you? This week, Australia avoided an alleged ISIS terrorist plot. Scottish voters rejected independence and decided to remain part of the UK. Oracle CEO Larry Ellison announced he'll step down. And today, the Chinese online retail giant Alibaba is going public on the New York Stock Exchange. Also, ProPublica teamed up with NPR to investigate debt collection and the cycle of debt and poverty. In the first ever study of its kind, they found that 4 million workers are having up to a quarter of their paychecks garnished to pay down consumer debt. Our guest writes, "This is a hidden burden for working class families." So we're going to hear all about that in this hour. We're joined by Paul Keel, who covers consumer finance for ProPublica. Recently, his focus has been on debt collection and high-cost lending. Paul is the author of The Great American Foreclosure Story, and he joins us on the phone from New York. Hi, Paul. Oh, do I have you?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Good to have you.
Okay.
We're also joined by Zoe Carpenter, who is a reporter in the nation's Washington, D.C. bureau. She's written for Rolling Stone and the Poughkeepsie Journal, and she joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Zoe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We always start by talking about good journalism that we've seen or heard or read this week. So let's start with you, Zoe. What piece of journalism do you want to highlight for us?
So I want to highlight a piece that's in the October issue of Harper's Magazine. Unfortunately, it's still behind paywall, but if you're not a subscriber to Harper's, you should be. It's called Today is Better Than Tomorrow, and it's by a former Marine named Benjamin Bush. And he returns to Iraq and to some of the areas where he toured in the Marines. And it's basically a portrait of, post-U.S. involvement, right before the U.S. is about to become seriously involved again. He was there in December. And mostly it's just conversations he has with local people, descriptions of the landscape. And I think it's a really wonderful and interesting and heartbreaking portrait of a country that I think most Americans don't have any kind of conceptualization of.
Even after this decade of war there. Well, very relevant
right.
to what we're going to be talking about. How about you, Paul? What do you want to highlight?
Yeah, I would say the thing that struck me the most, actually, was the New York Times has this Upshot blog, which is like basically deals with statistics of various, the various focus. But this week the Census Bureau put out information on, the poverty rate and median income in the U.S., and this was a post, the title was You Can't Feed a Family with GDP, and what it did was look at two different numbers that kind of tell the story of the economy over the last 15 years. One is the GDP, which, with other than recessions, has been on a pretty clear upward trajectory. But then if you look at that compared with median income, what happened was those two things kind of went together until about 1999. And then median income just kind of went sideways. So median income adjusted for inflation was actually much higher in 1999 than it is now. And it's something that's, I think, one of the biggest aspects or stories of our current economy, and you can't really understand what's happening out there, why it seems like, the stock market goes up and up and up, and why that hasn't really translated into people feeling better about the economy.
And the growing income inequality, or people who
right.
lost their jobs in the recession and haven't been able to find anything comparable. And you actually write about a lot of these people in your articles, looking at these consumer debts. So we'll talk about that in a minute. And we'll look at, are there intersections between the growing costs of paying for foreign wars and our economic health at home? So Zoe, let me start with you. The war on ISIS is increasing in scale. France launched its first airstrikes in Iraq. Yesterday, the Senate authorized the U.S. military to train and arm Syrian militants. The House also approved it. So what exactly will that mean in terms of an escalation of U.S. involvement?
Well, it means that we're committing ourselves to back a very uncertain group of rebels in Syria, and you know, there's been some good recent media coverage of some of the issues with doing that, in the sense that a lot of what those rebels are trying to do is really to oust the Assad regime. So it means we're putting ourselves more firmly into the Syrian civil war. You know, many of these groups that we're going to be arming are also fighting ISIS, but this is a conflict that is has in some ways very little to do with the U.S.'s objectives of destroying ISIS. And so I think it definitely is going to be a tricky thing to vet these rebels. And you know, I think the number of anti-war Democrats who were speaking out against this sort of arming and training was pretty low, but you did have a group of about 10 people in the Senate who were pretty vocally opposed, including Tammy Baldwin and Elizabeth Warren, notably, and Sherrod Brown from Ohio.
And Congress did not authorize the president to declare war on ISIS terrorists in Syria or Iraq. So can you kind of break down what this does and doesn't do?
Sure. So this vote was just on a bill to authorize training and arming for vetted Syrian rebels. So this is not any authorization for ground troops or even for strikes. And so what that means is that Congress is going to go on recess until past the midterms without having even debated the strikes that are already underway. And there are really serious implications of that legally in terms of the authorities that the president is using to carry out these military strikes. And so what the White House has been saying is that these authorizations that authorize the strikes against, the war on Afghanistan in 2001 and then the invasion of Iraq in 2003, that those authorizations are covering these strikes on ISIS. And that's a very shaky legal ground.
And it's very controversial. That's the authorizations for use of military force, often referred to as AUMF, that President Bush signed in 2001 and 2002. So, what are the controversies around that? We've got all kinds of legal scholars arguing that, yeah, that gives President Obama authority. No, it doesn't.
Right. So for the legal scholars who are raising questions about the legal authority, those questions are based around the assumption that ISIS has a relationship with al-Qaeda. Now, the 2001 authorization was specific to authorizing strikes against groups or individuals who participated in the 9/11 attacks. Now, at the time of the 9/11 attacks, ISIS and al-Qaeda were not linked. They had a relationship after the 9/11 attacks. And now, at the time that we're launching strikes, they also no longer have a relationship. Or, in fact, they have a relationship, and it's antagonistic. They are in a feud. So to say that Congress meant to authorize these strikes against ISIS 13 years ago is pretty ludicrous from the perspective of legal scholars who are raising these kinds of questions. It's a very tenuous link between al-Qaeda and ISIS.
And so the White House says that it needs about $500 million to pay for the arming and training of the rebels to fight ISIS. Where is that money going to come from? And has there been any debate around that?
It's going to come from the taxpayers, you know. We've already spent trillions in Iraq, and it looks like Congress is prepared to spend more to arm and train the rebels. We're also, Saudi Arabia has agreed to be a big part of that. A big part of that effort. So there will be money and assistance coming from them, although the details aren't clear yet.
So, Paul, let me bring you into this conversation. That $500 million just reminds me of the growing military budgets to pay for these wars, and now what looks like it could be a third one, although President Obama has said there will be no combat troops. But at the same time that we have these growing military budgets, we've had a shrinking middle class and a lack of investment in public infrastructure. When you look at these stories, these big debates over whether or not to arm rebels, how to spend our budgets, as you're reporting on income inequality, the growing income inequality, how do you look at this?
Well, I guess the closest parallel would be, I covered the TARP, you know, the bailout pretty closely, and there's just the attitude shifts a lot when you're talking about money that's going to people who are struggling with debt. I mean, when you were talking about the administration launching some sort of program to help people who were facing foreclosure, there was a lot of resistance to that, and ultimately that translated into programs that were not very effective. So the administration like promised to pay something like $50 billion towards those programs, and we've maybe spent $10 billion, you know, 6 years into it. So when you talk about defense and things like that, the frame of reference just seems to completely shift. So when we're talking about these types of large numbers.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the investigation for people who haven't read it, and we'll put links at yourcallradio.org. You really report on about 10% of workers between 35 to 44 had their wages garnered last year. Half of that was for child support, but the other half was to pay down consumer debt, and that some people are even having their entire savings account wiped out. Can you just talk about what led you to this investigation and what you found?
Sure. I mean, what led to me, and I've covered consumer finance for a while, and the thing that's kind of always struck me is that it's extremely common for, certainly credit card companies, but also sometimes hospitals, high-cost lenders like payday lenders, to go to court to sue people when they don't pay a debt. But there's no numbers on any of this stuff, even though this typically goes through a state court, and that has a lot to do with the fact that state courts, have systems that sometimes were put together in the 1980s or the 1990s. So it just always struck me that we don't have these numbers. How many people are having their paycheck cut down for debt like this? So we went to ADP. They're like this giant payroll services company. They process payments for millions of employees. And so they have this data, so they could do this analysis. And so they did it. And these are the numbers that came out. So I think the striking thing is it's disproportionately something that hits people who are earning basically under $40,000 a year. 25 to 40 was the income range that had the highest rates, and that was about 5% nationally. But regionally, it really varied. So Midwest was the worst, with about 6%. And so there are certain regions like the Northeast where this was much less common. And it's not really clear what the reasons for that are. I mean, certainly the economy in the Midwest is hurt, but there's also, laws in certain states that are much more favorable to creditors than might drive this sort of thing. So it's an area that we really should know more about, which is why we dug into it.
And what did you find? Like, what's the average debt or the median debt, and why are people getting into this? What sorts of circumstances are leading people to debt?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we don't have the number in terms of average debt. I mean, we saw a wide variation will be looked at. So in our stories, we had a guy who had a $7,000 credit card debt when the recession hit and lost his job and so couldn't pay it. But there's also a woman who had an $18,000, medical debt that she obviously couldn't pay because she was earning less than $30,000 a year. And I've seen, payday lenders go to court over $100. So it's a really wide range in terms of what happens to people. I think one of the main messages we wanted to, communicate was that there's just extremely little thought that went into any of these laws. So one thing we focus on is the main federal law that governs all this stuff was passed in 1968, and that was because at the time it was seen as a problem that you had, less than conscientious lenders lending money to struggling working people, and then when they couldn't pay, there were basically no limits at the time, so they could basically take all of their wages, and that was seen as a bad thing. And so there was a movement of Congress to do something about it. And, there was backroom deals and compromises, and out of that came this 25% number, which is the max they can take out of your paycheck now. But if you look at, federal, surveys of what people earn and what the household balance sheet looks like for a lot of families, it's just crystal clear that that 25% for people, particularly in the lower end of the income spectrum, is just impossible.
And originally in 1968, they wanted it to be 10%, right?
The House had a 10% number, and then out of that, you know, out of the conference committee, because there is a lot of resistance in the Senate, you know, some Republicans didn't even want to do this at all, and so that's how they came out with this number. It was like, well, if you're pushing for this, it's better than allowing them to take half, you know. And it was an improvement from the current state of affairs, but it was not a number that seems to have been based on anything actual. So you can look at data, and it's just clear that if you take a quarter of someone's income away, that's going to lead to, you know, other choices like, well, do we not pay the power now? Do we skimp on health care? You know, it's a domino effect.
And Paul, speaking of that domino effect, the other thing that you write about are these high interest rates that people are stuck with, so that what was originally a $2,000 debt can be doubled or tripled over the course of that debt. Well, somebody's trying to pay it down, you know, say $200 a month, and just gets trapped in this cycle that continues even after a court order to sort of have a payment schedule.
Yeah, and that's not, we focused on a man in Missouri, but that certainly happens in other states where this is a penalty rate on a credit card from Capital One. It was at 26%, and it never stopped. So it doubled to over $15,000, and I think that's another instance of no one, you know, there's wide variation in states. So there's some states that don't let that happen. They cap the interest at 2% after they go to court and get a judgment against you. So I think probably the biggest kind of problem is bank account garnishments. So we were talking about how federal law stops them from taking more than a quarter of your paycheck. But if you put that paycheck in your bank account, there's no federal protection from them taking everything in your bank account, which obviously makes little sense if you know, there's an agreement that we want to leave something for people to live on. So it's something that, that's something we don't have any numbers on. So with this report, it allowed us to say, well, there's 4 million people who have had their wages garnished in 2013 over consumer debt, but we don't know how many people had their bank accounts cleaned out. And from what I've seen, looking at various court cases, it's a pretty common recourse that creditors take.
That's Paul Keel. He's a reporter with ProPublica and has just done an investigation into growing consumer debt and wage garnishment. We're also joined by Zoe Carpenter, who reports for The Nation. It's our Friday Media Roundtable on Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. And Zoe, you know, you were talking about the $500 million that President Obama has said it's going to cost to fund this new escalation of the, I don't know if we call it a war, the attempt to combat ISIS, or the terrorist threat of ISIS, as the president has put it. As Paul is talking about this spiral of debt, do you try and connect these issues for your reporters as you're writing about sort of the machinations of D.C. politics?
Yeah, I mean, that's not something specifically that I have connected in terms of consumer debt, comparing it to the kind of national debt we're incurring by our military adventures overseas. But I think it's definitely something to think about, why we can justify the expenditures on quote-unquote nation building abroad, which is a term I use ironically, versus nation building at home, and you know, what could we do with that $500 million that's supposed to go to the Syrian rebels here, when we have, you know, our schools are crumbling, we have people in debt who don't have relief. I think that's a real political quagmire that we're in, that we keep making those choices to put that money to the military. And I think it's worth mentioning here that $500 million, that's just for arming and training rebels. That's That has nothing to do with the airstrikes or the cost of greater escalation, which will likely be significantly higher than $500 million.
And I just struggled to give a definition to what this escalation is. How do you characterize this new involvement?
Well, that's a great question. I think that's something that's that is definitely something that's being debated in the military, in the media right now. You know, of course, the administration won't call it a war, because that brings up a lot of legal questions, both in terms of domestic legal constraints and international constraints. But I think it's pretty clear that the line between boots on the ground and between airstrikes is a political line, and it's, you know, if we're dropping bombs on a country, to me that seems like war, regardless of whether we're actually firing from the ground also. But, you know, I think that officially it's certainly not being called a war.
So we'll call it a campaign for now. So how different is this campaign from what the U.S. is doing in Yemen or Pakistan, for example?
Well, I think the administration is arguing that it's not that dissimilar. That's one of their justifications for this campaign, is that it's just part of the ongoing counterterrorism operations that we're involved in all over the world. And that itself should be troubling, that we have these sorts of air campaigns, mostly initiated by drone strikes, going on in so many different countries, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, for example. However, I think while it's true that these new strikes in Iraq and potentially in Syria sort of fit the pattern of the Obama administration acting on its own to do counterterrorism strategy, this is a very different kind of campaign. I think having declared that our goal is to completely eliminate ISIS rather than just contain the threat, as we seem to be doing in other countries, that puts us in a really different kind of situation where it seems very tricky to see how we could actually fully eliminate ISIS without having a full-scale war.
And we only have about 2 minutes before our break, but for those who haven't been following this closely, can you explain more about the genesis of ISIS and why it is perceived as so different from insurrections in Yemen and Pakistan?
Well, I think ISIS has a better social media strategy. They're certainly an incredibly brutal group. I don't think we should downplay that at all. They're doing horrible things. But so is Boko Haram. So are many other violent militant groups all over the world. I think that the beheading videos were extremely successful in the sense that they did exactly what ISIS seems to want, which is to draw the U.S. further in. You know, what a terrorist group does is spread terror, and ISIS has done that very effectively throughout the U.S. If you look at polling, Americans believe that there is more of a threat than the intelligence sources are actually saying. The administration has been very clear that there is no evidence of a direct threat to the U.S. from ISIS, and certainly there is a threat to many people in the Middle East from ISIS. But I think that it's the very public media campaign that this group has engaged in that really makes them stand out. And, of course, our prior involvement in Iraq, which led to some of the political conditions that have nurtured ISIS, that also gives us a sort of special relationship.
Well, and they are rapidly taking over parts of Iraq and Syria.
That is a good point. They control a large swath of territory, and the fact that they are so strong militarily in the region is certainly a special concern.
That is Zoe Carpenter, who reports for The Nation. We're also joined by Paul Keel, a reporter with ProPublica. He's been reporting on the escalating consumer debt and garnishment of wages, also clearing out bank accounts of low-income workers. And he has said that it's a hidden burden for working-class families. We'll talk more about that investigation in the second half of your call. We'll also be hearing from you. The number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you have an experience with consumer debt or going to court to settle a debt, give us a call. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back to take your calls after this short break.
Back to more of Your Call in just a moment. We invite you to join us. You can send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org or join us live at... Coming up at 11 on World Have Your Say, we'll hear some reaction from Scotland, but also hear what people around the UK make of the results of yesterday's election. The huge turnout in Scotland energized political debate across the U.S. We'll hear about the consequences of the vote and how it's rippling out well beyond Scotland. World Have Your Say coming up at 11 o'clock here on KALW.
know how. For those of you joining us now, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. On Monday, how is NAFTA and also the so-called war on drugs, how are they affecting Mexico? We'll feature a conversation Rose had with investigative journalist Charles Bowden, who passed away on August 30th. His writing explored the long-lasting effects of poverty, violence, and the drug trade on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at feedback at Your Call Radio. It's our weekly media roundtable today, and I'm joined by Zoe Carpenter, who reports for The Nation, and ProPublica's Paul Keel. Paul Keel covers consumer finance for ProPublica, and recently his focus has been on debt collection and high-cost lending. We'll talk more with Paul about that and take your calls. Zoe Carpenter reports from Washington, D.C. for The Nation, and she's written for Rolling Stone, the Poughkeepsie Journal, and she joins us from D.C., as I said. So, Zoe, I just wanted to ask you one more quick question, because we kind of papered over it pretty quickly. You know, ISIS is really being covered by the media as this incredibly growing threat, and it very well may be. And obviously, the beheading videos, the rapid takeover of territory in Iraq and Syria is alarming. But what was interesting is that you point out, and the New York Times is pointing out, that intelligence sources say that the threat from ISIS is being grossly exaggerated. And earlier this week, General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that if necessary, he might recommend the use of U.S. military ground forces. So can you just delve a little bit more into what militaries and intelligence sources are saying about the ISIS threat?
Sure. There are a lot of conflicting messages coming from the military, from intelligence sources, and from the White House. I think Dempsey's comment was really raised some alarm for people who had who'd been hearing from the White House that there was a red line against boots on the ground. And I think from the military's perspective, they have a fair point, which is that once we start engaging more seriously, we don't really know what's going to happen. We can't control all of the outcomes. And so certainly there may be a time when what's seen as being most effective militarily would be to introduce more ground forces. I should also point out that there are already American military personnel on the ground, more than 1,000 of them, who are called advisors, but that's a very squishy term. Meanwhile, we have the intelligence sources saying that while ISIS is, of course, a really serious problem in Iraq and Syria and to the region generally, there isn't any threat here. And I think that wasn't really made clear by the media up until, you know, just after the president's speech. So I think we've seen a real shift in the media coverage in just the past week from before the president's speech, being really concerned with style and whether he was, putting on a strong enough face, to now actually starting to ask some of the serious questions about the inconsistencies and gaps in the strategy. Such as, what do we do if there is serious blowback because of airstrikes? Do we really have a red line on boots on the ground? How might this military, quote-unquote, solution be canceling out other diplomatic solutions? So, there are all these different pieces coming from the various agencies that don't quite match up, and I think that's a real cause of concern for anyone who doesn't want to see America drawn into another full-scale conflict in the Middle East.
That's Zoe Carpenter. She reports for The Nation. We're also joined on our Friday Media Roundtable by Paul Keel, who is a reporter with ProPublica. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and let's take some of your calls. Let's go to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for a good program, as usual. I particularly enjoyed the surveys on Friday morning. I have a couple of questions. First of all, constitutionally speaking, is it proper for a general, top general of the U.S. Army in charge, to make a suggestion that we should cross the red line? I find this hard to believe. This is the sort of recommendation one would expect the general to make in private to the President of the Republic. So constitutionally, does that make sense? That's my question. And then I heard the other day on the air, yesterday or the day before, in conjunction with the whole issue of ISIS and what have you, that historically speaking, the U.S. has formally approved war only on a very few occasions, 4 or 5 times. So all of these years when the U.S. has been involved in warfare for various reasons, these things have never been formally approved by the Congress of this country. So that's my second question, and I'll stop here and take your answer off the air.
Thanks very much, Max. Zoe, why don't you go ahead and answer?
You know, I'm sorry, I actually couldn't hear Max at all. There was some interference on the phone line. I can hear you fine, if you don't mind rephrasing the question.
So his first question was about this whole question of boots on the ground and drawing a red line, and is it proper for top generals to be speaking out about this?
Well, I don't know about propriety. I think, you know, he was being asked very directly by lawmakers in a setting where he was under oath, and I think that it was General Dempsey's obligation to respond honestly in that setting. And so I think it's very telling that the honest answer from the general about, you know, the very real prospects for a slippery slope here don't really line up with the boundaries that the administration is drawing itself.
And then Max's second question was, wars being waged without the War Powers Act being used, without proper authorization or with a different kind of authorization, like the one from 2001, 2002, authorizations for the use of military force as opposed to actually having Congress declare war.
Right. So there are many ways that Congress could go about authorizing this, and there are lawmakers who have called for a new authorization. Some of those lawmakers seem to be calling for that authorization so they have a chance to, you know, prove that they're hawks. They seem very eager to authorize it. There are other calls for authorization that seem more designed to actually put boundaries around the mission and would actually repeal the 2001 and the 2002 authorizations that have been used pretty broadly.
And let me invite listeners to join our Friday Media Roundtable. We're speaking with Zoe Carpenter, who reports for The Nation and has been covering the congressional debate over the authorization of training and arming the Syrian rebels to combat ISIS. And we're also speaking with Paul Keel, who's a reporter with ProPublica and has been looking at increasing consumer debt and wage garnishment. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. You can join us by calling 866-798. That's 866-798-8255. And if you're somebody who ended up in debt because of a health crisis, let us know what happened. If you've ever been in deep debt or had experience with a debt collector, let us know what that experience was like. 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And do you think that this escalation in the fight against ISIS makes sense? Should the U.S. be doing more? Should there be more debate over the potential of entering into an escalating war in the Middle East? 866-798-TALK, or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to Wanda, who I think is in Berkeley. Hi, Wanda. Welcome to Your Call.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to point up an inconsistency in your guest Paul Keel's report about the laws being passed that are really putting people, making them indentured slaves, basically. And he said, just as an aside, little thought went into these laws. But then on the other hand, he's saying that, you know, backroom deals, but what his job really needs to be is to report to us, the people, who is doing this, and that we need to be able to stop it, and we need to find out exactly, name some names of what companies or what senators have written these bills. For whom? So that's what I would really appreciate from journalism. It just feels like these constant conversations that go over and over. Well, we're feeling viscerally these things. We don't need a journalist to just keep telling us what's happening because we know what's happening.
Let's hear from Paul. Paul, were you able to hear Wanda?
Yeah, I did hear that. I mean, I guess first, we have been able to get a lot of data in terms of who is doing the suing, and that'll be part of our coverage this year. So I don't want to get ahead of myself with that. But there are some companies that are responsible for a large number of lawsuits, and we will be focusing some coverage on that. With regard to who is responsible for the laws, the only law is from 1968, right? So I was trying to find people who were in this room, but they're all dead because no real thought has been given to this issue, more or less, you know, in over 40 years. And I think one of the reasons why that has not occurred is because there has been no data to show that how widespread this is. So, you know, you will have, you know, consumer advocates come forward and say this is happening a lot. Probably the only major thing that has happened in this area was that it got to be such a problem that, you know, credit card companies or whatever were cleaning out the bank accounts of people who were living only on Social Security, which is against federal law. That's one of the few things that's protected in every state. They were cleaning out people's bank accounts who were living on Social Security, that there was a groundswell to force a change in the rules. So that changed about 2011 or so, so that now if you get your Social Security checks electronically deposited in your bank account, the bank will should automatically know that and protect that amount if a creditor comes out and tries to clean out your bank account. But beyond that, there hasn't been very much movement on this. So if you're looking to hold, you know, lawmakers' account, there's people in office right now who could be doing something about this, and we'll see if something happens coming out of this reporting.
You know, Paul, I'm thinking about the larger economic impact. I'm thinking, you know, if you've got 4 million workers who are having low income workers who are having a quarter or, you know, around that amount of their wages garnished, taken out of their bank accounts each month, what's the larger economic impact? I mean, that's money that would have been spent by those people almost assuredly, that's instead going to large corporations, to the profit margin there. What is the larger impact?
That's a very good question. I mean, I think there's actually been a lot of important work recently just showing how damaging, like, a debt overhang can be for an economy. You know, we went through that particularly with mortgages. Student loans is a big problem. And I think one important aspect of this is there really was just a tidal wave of lawsuits filed in courts in the years of recession. So like 2007 through about 2011, before and after the recession. And because there's a judgment in court against this person, that doesn't go away. That stays around for years. So it is, I think, a hidden drag on the economy, and particularly with, you know, in areas that probably have a higher proportion of people who are lower income. So it's another thing that, you know, there's been no research because no one knows how prevalent this is. So we're just hopefully starting to put some real numbers to things so that people can, you know, learn more about it and then set policy accordingly.
That's Paul Keel. He's a reporter with ProPublica, and they've been investigating consumer debt and wage garnishment. Zoe Carpenter is also joining us on the Media Roundtable. She reports for The Nation. It's your call. I'm Holly Kernan. You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also post comments at yourcallradio.org, which has links to all of the articles that we're talking about, and you can post other articles there. Let's go to Jeff in Berkeley. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to your call.
Thank you. This is hard, it's complicated, but basically I lost over $100,000 in investment, and I had a lot of credit card debt. Credit card debt is sold for 2, 3, 4% on the dollar to collection firms, large national firms. And what I came across was a letter which is basically a demand for, do you really own the note? And there are 12 things on it. Now, I live in Alameda County, which is a good place to live if they take you to court, because they're not going to win. They don't own the debt. They don't have the paperwork. They don't have the documentation. You send them this letter, ideally certified or priority mail with a signature, and they go away, almost always. Sometimes they pass it on to one of their companion firms, and you send the second letter to that firm, and then they do go away.
So if you push back,
Mr. Keel, I will, if you have an email address at ProPublica, I'll send you by email a copy of this letter, generic with my name whited out, and you can take a look at it. But let me tell you, it works. Now, it only works for credit card debt. It doesn't have anything to do with bankruptcy. You avoid that completely. Your credit is trashed, but your credit's going to be trashed anyway. But this gets the bill collectors out of state or in state trying to collect money from you and makes them go away. It's like holding the cross up to the vampire.
Can I ask you a question, Jeff? In the comments section on Paul's articles, a lot of people were saying, listen, if you get yourself into debt, you have a responsibility to pay off that debt. It's outrageous that you would think that you should just fight back and get it erased. What do you say to people who are having comments like that, Jeff?
What has happened with the credit card, and Paul probably knows more about this, the bank has written it off. They write it off in a period of 6 months if it hasn't been paid. So they've taken a tax deduction on it. I'm not dealing with the moral issue of it. It's there. There's nothing you can do about it. There's no sense in having your life messed up for, you know, the rest of your life messed up for it. So basically, you are essentially doing a de facto bankruptcy. Now, look, I'm an educated person. I have some business experience, but not really in either the legal area of debt. But I know what I know. And what I found this out, and I've used this, and it's worked, and that's why I'd like to, if the reporter on this, Mr. Keeley, is doing any work on it, this will make a lot of sense to him.
So, Jeff, we'll stay on the line, and our producer, Malihe, will give you Paul's email so that you can email him, but let's let Paul respond.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think one big underlying aspect of this call is there are these companies, you know, they're usually called debt buyer companies. They really kind of they emerged in the 1990s and then kind of exploded in the middle of last decade. And the business is you buy portfolios of defaulted accounts, it's almost all credit card debt, and you try to collect on those. And a number of those companies, in addition to just trying to collect over the phone, will go to court if the statute of limitations hasn't expired in that state. And they go to court in very large numbers. And I think that's one of the things that has, led to somewhat of a sea change in terms of how common, you know, wage garnishment is, because you have this whole class of company that is much more likely to go to court about it. And it is true that if a consumer gets an attorney who knows how to handle these types of cases and they're sued by a debt buyer, often the debt buyer will just drop the suit because the economics or the business economics of this is you sue thousands of people, you hope, and based on past evidence, there's, you know, you can rely on the fact that most of them won't show up. And if they don't show up, you get a default judgment. If they do show up and they start, you know, they have a lawyer and they start asking you about the chain of title and how can you prove you owe this debt, then oftentimes they'll just drop the case because that's not really what the business is about. The business is about volume. And so that's one certainly a large aspect of what's happening in court.
Well, Paul, can you talk a little bit more about the court system? Because that was a really fascinating part, and you point out that the debt collection agencies always come to court with a lawyer. The debtors frequently don't show up. Sometimes the summons are not getting to them. They rarely have lawyers, and the deck is kind of stacked against them. Can you just explain how that system actually works?
Yeah, sure. So we were able to look at data for just one Missouri county, and I have every reason to believe this is representative, is that, you know, like you said, almost always the company that was suing the debtor was represented by an attorney. In about 7% of cases, the defendant was represented. And if you think about why that might be, it's obvious that if you're being sued over debt, you probably don't have a lot of money to hire an attorney, or you don't think that the attorney is going to be able to take your case, so you don't bother. So that's just the state of affairs that occurs in the courts. So it's obviously not, you know, a fair fight. And
you also say that though sometimes lawyers for the debt collection agencies will actually use tactics whereby if a debtor shows up in court, they'll ask for a continuance just to kind of make it harder on that person who maybe had to take a day off of work. And obviously these are low income individuals for the most part.
Yeah, there was a judge in St. Louis who was complaining about that. He said he saw that a lot. You know, and for a debtor, it's often they're working. You know, it's not easy to take time off work. Maybe if you're on like an hourly wage or something like that, you ask for time off, and then, you know, why they would ask for a continuance. Certainly the less generous interpretation is that they're just looking to keep on continuing the case until you don't show up, and then they get a default judgment. They would probably say, "Well, I wasn't ready to have a trial or something like that." But it's, you know, there's lots of ways that using the court system can end up being, you know, a scary, intimidating process for someone who's not used to that, and just how casual, you know, it is. You know, creditors always say it's a last resort. We'd much rather, you know, someone just pay us or be on a payment plan. And, you know, I do believe that if someone were just given money, that is easier for them because there are some costs to go into court. On the other hand, it's an extremely common resource for creditors and collectors to take. So it's not like it's something that it's only, you know, the worst, you know, type of debtor who is, you know, obviously has the resources to pay. No, that's not really the situation. It's often people who are really stretched paycheck to paycheck, but since they have a job, they're eligible to have their wages garnishment, so they're a good target for a lawsuit.
Well, and I think I heard this on your series, something I heard on NPR, that essentially if you go and you fight and you say, well, wait a second, show me the proof that you actually own a debt that is attributable to me, that oftentimes they'll say, okay, we're not going to bother with that one.
Yeah, particularly these debt buyer cases that your caller was talking about.
Yeah, and Jeff is probably a really good illustration of that, fighting back. How much of this debt is attributable to student loans? I know that you profiled somebody whose debt was about student loans. How does that factor in, and is that going to be an increasing piece of this? The legislation or the laws around student loan debt are different.
Yeah, they are different. They're so different, in fact, that they don't. If it's government-backed debt, which is the vast majority of student loans, they don't have to take you to court. So there's this kind of system they've set up that has an administrative process. You have to be at least 9 months behind on your loan, and then you would get something in the mail saying that, you know, we're going to pursue wage garnishment. And then after that, it's different amounts, 15% of a paycheck. But they have a different powers. Like, so for instance, they can go after your tax refund in the spring. Even if you're on Social Security, it would be illegal for, you know, a credit card company to garnish somebody's Social Security checks, but for student loans, it's a whole different system, so they're allowed to do that in some cases. So it's just a whole different setup. We did see a big rise in this type of wage garnishment through the end of the decade. To me, there's a whole different set of issues just because there are a whole different set of federal laws that govern it.
And Zoe, let me turn back to you and the fact that Congress authorized the Pentagon to train and arm Syrian rebels to fight against ISIS. Before the president made his speech about the necessity of the escalation of war on ISIS in Iraq and Syria, the president met with a group of influential journalists, and Political noted that the goal of those kinds of special meetings, according to past participants, is to help shape how journalists think and how they cover the issue and how it ensures that the president's point of view will be represented in the media. It's certainly not the first time that kind of a meeting has taken place, but how successful do you think the president has been in shaping the coverage of this and public opinion?
I think it's really hard to tell because there's so much that we don't know about what is said at those off-the-record meetings versus what's said in calls with reporters, with officials when it's on the record. I think this administration has been sort of historically closed-lipped and has relied a lot more on those sort of off-the-record or background-only conversations than on official press conferences. And the fact that the president hasn't taken that many direct questions on the record from reporters about the strategy in Iraq and Syria, it is pretty worrisome because there are so many questions that remain outstanding about the strategy. And so to not have answers to those questions either in the media or not have a debate in Congress about them is a pretty serious gap, I think.
Do you expect that there is going to be a fuller debate after the midterm elections?
I think that it will be certainly fuller than it is now. It remains to be seen who is really going to be vocal about making sure that that happens. I think certainly there will be people, you know, perhaps John McCain and Lindsey Graham, Republican senators, who are going to be very vocal about trying to increase military action. And then we'll see the sort of other side of that coming from the Congressional Progressive Caucus, who have called for a debate in a way that seems to suggest that they're, that caucus is more hesitant about further action. So, yes, it'll happen after the midterms, but meanwhile, we will have been bombing Iraq for months by then.
Mm-hmm. Paul, what stands out for you as you look at how the debate in Congress is being covered in terms of this escalation in our involvement in Iraq and Syria?
Well, I mean, it seems pretty typical of Congress these days in that, you know, thoughtfulness and you know, it's an institution that's in pretty bad state.
Well, let me ask you one final thing, just like 30 seconds here. What are the prospects for reform now that you've blown the whistle on this? Will consumers get some sort of bailout in the same way or relief in the same way banks did?
Well, we'll have to certainly keep track of that. I think there's some really common sense things that could happen. So we'll continue to hopefully shed on light in this, and that hopefully will lead to something.
All right. That is Paul Keel, who's a reporter with ProPublica. We'll put links to his reports on the debt crisis and garnering of wages, and he'll continue to cover that. That'll be at yourcallradio.org. We've also been joined by Zoe Carpenter from The Nation. Thank you both for joining us. Thanks for everybody's calls and emails. We apologize that we couldn't get to all of you. You can continue to comment at yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. How are NAFTA and the so-called war on drugs affecting Mexico? On the next Your Call, we'll feature a conversation Rose had with investigative journalist Charles Bowden, who passed away on August 30th. His writing explored the long-lasting effects poverty, violence, and the drug trade are having on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. Rose spoke with Charles about his book Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. That's on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. We'll be right back.